Enjoy.
La longue marche des femmes haïtiennes de la sœur à la mère. Dans les premières pages de son ouvrage Formação da Literatura Brasileira, au chapitre intitulé Literatura como Sistema, Antônio Cândido donne sa définition de la tradition. Donc, un texte est Maximilien. Donc, je crois qu'il s'agit là d'une définition taillée sur mesure dont je vais m'inspirer pour retracer de la sœur à la mère l'évolution d'une représentation de la lutte des femmes dans le roman haïtien. Polysémie du terme « maman ». Même l'haïtien qui utilise avec la plus grande pertinence les mots de sa langue natale, le créole haïtien, le fait le plus souvent en ignorant l'ensemble des performances stylistiques de sa langue, faute de l'avoir étudié. Il pourrait par exemple s'écrier devant un spectacle qui s'offre à lui « coup maman l'amant, comme maman l'amant » et croire qu'il ne fait que se servir de mots par simple allitération. Il ignorait que « maman l'amant » est le nom d'une plante. Fils Alice, à propos de laquelle le dictionnaire Robert nous dit ceci, « plante vivace, solanacée, appelée aussi amour en cage, dont le calice grand renflé, contenant le fruit à maturité, est très décoratif. » Donc, l'exclamation de ce locuteur étant en fait une métaphore célébrant la merveille de la mère portant en elle la vie nouvelle, comme la plante évoquée. Donc, ce n'était pas une simple musique de mots sans lien logique. « Comment lent » serait ainsi un équivalent de l'admiratif « Mamma mia ». En haïtien, c'est-à-dire dans la langue créole des haïtiens, « maman » correspond à « maman » en français. Et « maman » est sous sa forme abrégément, renvoie généralement à « maman petite », la mère d'un enfant, et naturellement, ils servent à traduire toute la tendresse ou la vénération d'un enfant pour sa mère. Et c'est ce que traduit ce vers d'une chanson où l'on dit tautologiquement « maman, c'est maman, une mère, c'est une mère ». D'ailleurs, il n'est pas rare d'entendre quelqu'un s'adressant à une vieille dame dont il ignore le nom, l'appeler par politesse « la mère ». Mais plus couramment, et on se sert de maman pour s'adresser à sa propre mère ou pour parler de la mère de quelqu'un. Donc, le mot « maman » peut désigner aussi la femme aimée, celle en bas, en particulier qui nous fait souffrir. Comme on le dit dans cette chanson, « Hi, maman, nanote, oh, nanote chérie, pour qui ça va faire me souffrir? Pourquoi me fais-tu souffrir ?» Cette souffrance peut naître souvent que la plainte de celui qui s'étonne hypocritement d'être repoussé. Est-ce que c'est parce que je pas travaille? Est-ce que parce que je ne travaille pas? Ou a fait me passer un travail que tu me fais des misères? Alors, le mot maman, synonyme de l'indulgence sans limite, autorise alors l'amoureux à quémander les faveurs de sa belle, comme il le fait dans cette autre chanson, « Ti maman ». Fais qui choye pour moi, petite mère, fais-moi plaisir. Pas quitter m'aller, ne me renvoie pas. Donc le moment, abrégé de maman, peut s'associer aussi bien avec le nom de la personne désignée, Mancia, qu'avec celui du conjoint de cette personne, comme dans Man Dodo, la femme de Dodo, et qui prend le sens de maman petite Dodo, la mère des enfants de Dodo. Donc, sur les registres des sentiments, le mot « maman » ou son diminutif man peut donc traduire toute une gamme de sentiments et de situations, et c'est ainsi qu'il élargit son sens pour désigner non seulement des personnes, mais même des objets comme dans Maman Kai, la grande maison, Maman l'argent, le gros du trésor, ou encore Maman Pimba, le nom donné au canon de gros calibre placé dans la citadelle, la ferrière, pour défendre le pays dans le cas de retour des Français. Il y a donc une sorte de réversibilité du mot « maman » ou de son équivalent « man » qui lui permet tantôt nom, tantôt épithète, de passer de l'amour à la guerre ou, si l'on préfère, du positif au négatif. Il peut désigner alors tout ce qui est important, étonnant ou même menaçant. Le terme « maman » renvoie alors à tout ce qui dépasse les proportions ordinaires des choses, ce qui est impressionnant, terrifiant à la limite. On parle alors de « maman loup-garou » pour désigner les sorcières qui rôdent la nuit, ou de « sans maman » pour parler de gens sans foi ni loi. Le terme « maman » peut aussi servir pour insulter. Et si ailleurs, on le fait elliptiquement en disant « Hey, ta mère !» En haïtien, on le fait pour plus crûment en lançant « coulant guette, maman, comme le clitoris de ta mère. » Donc, c'est dans cette perspective d'un élargissement constant du sens du mot « maman » qu'on arrive à l'employer pour parler du pays, la mère patrie en somme, avec toutes les nuances d'affection, de vénération, de nostalgie, mais aussi de culpabilité ou même d'espoir désespéré, si l'on peut ainsi parler. À preuve sévère d'une chanson faisant la louange d'Haïti et qui se termine par ce souhait « Haïti, Haïti !» Haïti, Haïti, maman chérie, Haïti, mère chérie, c'est dans bras pour mourir, je veux mourir dans tes bras. Est-ce le rêve de retrouver le confort et la paix du fœtus qui n'a pas encore affronté le monde tel qu'il est, ou celui de renaître à une vie nouvelle, comme semblait le souhaiter le roi Christophe, dont l'emblème était le phénix, l'oiseau qui renaît de ses cendres? Cette image de la mort dans les bras de la mère chérie nous porte à croire que dans ce cas, le rêve ultime du poète est double. D'abord, mettre fin au malheur présent, et ensuite recommencer la vie avec un avenir plus clément, se reforger en somme une nouvelle histoire. Mais dans ce rêve de réincarnation s'insinue souvent le sentiment de culpabilité de ne pas avoir suffisamment témoigné de tendresse à cette mère qui a donné le jour à son enfant, ou même le regret de s'être montré ingrat à son égard. Il y a ainsi pas mal de chansons qui dénonce le fils ingrat qui s'est élevé dans l'échelle sociale grâce au sacrifice d'une mère qu'à présent il méprise et rejette. Ces diverses attitudes à l'égard de la mère patrie s'insèrent dans une vision extrêmement large de la famille. Un dicton populaire ne dit-il pas « Voisinage, c'est famille, les voisins sont des parents. » Le parent, ce n'est donc pas seulement les membres de la famille nucléaire, mais aussi les voisins, ceux qui habitent la même rue, le même quartier, la même ville, le même pays, ou encore ces voisins qui habitent de l'autre côté de la frontière, la même île, le même continent et la même planète Terre. Un passage de gouverneur de la Rosée illustre bien cette vision de l'autre comme moi, à l'opposé du fameux « je est un autre ». « Et moi aussi !» cria le Sémidor. Il venait d'avaler coup sur coup deux verres de clairin. « J'ai traversé plusieurs fois la frontière. Ces Dominicains-là, ce sont des gens comme nous-mêmes. » Sauf qu'ils ont une couleur plus rouge que les nègres d'Haïti, et leurs femmes sont des mulâtresses à grandes crinières. J'ai connu J'ai connu une de ces bougresses. Elle était bien grasse pour dire la vérité. Antonio, qu'elle m'appelait, voilà comment elle m'appelait. Eh bien, question de comparaison avec les femmes d'ici, rien ne lui manquait. Elle avait de tout et de bonne qualité, je pourrais faire un serment, mais destine et destine.
Good evening. This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the station management, Tufts University Administration, or Board of Trustees. Tonight we have a very important show hosted by Bonnie Faulkner, Guns and Butter, from the Pacifica Radio Network in California. You can find a complete historical archive of all past shows at gunsandbutter.org and also via your favorite podcast app. I will be back every other Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. with more information. And now, Bonnie Faulkner.
This is Guns and Butter.
They know that this system that we're living under right now, that this system is broken and will never be repaired. I think what we're seeing right now is that the whole world is in danger of facing the biggest financial takedown in history.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Ernst Wolf. Today's show, The End Game. Ernst Wolf is an author and journalist living in Berlin. He has written four books in German on the relationship between the financial system and politics, including Financial Tsunami, soon to be out in English, Wolf of Wall Street, a printed version of a collection of short videos explaining different aspects of the financial system, and Pillaging the World, the History and Politics of the IMF, available in English. He has also written a children's book in German. Ernst Wolf was born in Tianjin, China, spent his childhood in Seoul, Korea, went to school in Germany, and studied in the U.S., but was expelled from the U.S. in 1970 for writing three articles against the Vietnam War. Ernst Wolf, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'd always been shocked by the video clips of speeches made by the young Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, and her hard line regarding lockdowns, even going so far as to say that no one in New Zealand was allowed to smoke a cigarette. I recently saw a short embedded video of a New Zealander claiming that Jacinda Ardern does not represent the people of New Zealand, but that she works for the World Economic Forum. He then said to check out the Young Global Leaders program of the WEF. When I did that, I saw her listed there along with Mark Zuckerberg. I then clicked on alumni of the Young Global Leaders, and so many of the presidents and prime ministers of countries showed up. Of course, this led to your research into this program. I have been mystified as to how almost the entire world is coordinated to enact the very same policies at the same time, and this Young Global Leaders program seems to be the missing link. How did you become aware of this program?
Well, see, I lived in Switzerland for quite a while, and I always saw these meetings they had in January. Like, for 50 years, they've held meetings in Davos, which is a small winter resort in Switzerland. And I was kind of taken aghast because there were like 1,500 private jets that landed there. And there were people from all over the world meeting there. And those were extremely rich people and extremely powerful people. So I looked into this thing and I found out that this WEF was founded in 1971. And that it started to kind of become a training ground for the international corporate and political elite in 1992. That's when they started their first class. That was the class of 1993. And in that class, you will find names like Angela Merkel, the German chancellor. You will find Nicolas Sarkozy, who used to be the president of France. You will find Bill Gates in there. And you will find other names like Manuel Barroso, who was the head of the European Union. So you'll find all sorts of very, very prominent politicians and corporate leaders in there. And this training program has been going on for several years. And they've even started a new program. In the beginning, it was called Global Leaders for Tomorrow. And then they changed the name into Young Global Leaders. And now they've started a new program a few years ago, which is called Global Shapers. And they have 500, I think it's about 500 hubs all over the world where people meet, and they have gathered around around about 10,000 people to join that organization. So that is really like the place where the elite of the world is being trained and is being prepared for their jobs.
How do participants enter the Young Global Leaders program, or are they chosen?
They're not chosen. They have to apply. They have to apply, and then they're picked out. They have to undergo some kind of questioning, and then they're either approved or denied admission. The thing is that the global leaders of tomorrow and the young global leaders, they had to be under the age of 40, and now the young global shapers, they have to be under the age of 30. So the young global shapers, that's mostly people who have aspirations in politics, but also that's a lot of leaders of young startup companies, mostly in the IT arena.
An article on your research by Michael Lord states that, quote, California Governor Gavin Newsom is on the list, who was selected for the class of 2005, as well as former presidential candidate and current U.S. Secretary of Transportation Peter Buttigieg, who is a very recent alumnus, having been selected for the class of 2019. So it's not just leaders of countries who pass through this WEF program, but politicians at many levels of government.
That's true. That's true. Politicians at many levels of government, like the German health minister of our last government here, he was a member of the Young Global Leaders, and we have several politicians here in Germany who are not very prominent outside of Germany, but they've all also undergone these courses. And among the big business leaders, you will also find, I've already mentioned Bill Gates, you will also find Jeff Bezos there, and you will also find Steve Ballmer there, who was once the CEO of Microsoft. So you'll have the complete elite of the world that has been trained by Mr. Klaus Schwab, who is a German professor, who is about 80 years old now. I think he's 83 now. And he started this World Economic Forum in 1971. Interestingly, he was a student of Henry Kissinger's at Harvard University. And I think that Harvard University plays a big role, because these people are all sent to Harvard University for some time in order to attend some classes there.
1971 was also the year that the dollar went off the gold standard during Richard Nixon's presidency and his Svengali Henry Kissinger, whom you've just mentioned. Do you think that the creation of the World Economic Forum and the dollar going off the gold standard are related?
It might be a coincidence, but it might be related. If it is, I mean, your president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, once said, nothing in politics happens by accident. It's all planned. And if you think something happened by accident, and if you look into it, you will find out that it was planned. So there might have been a plan behind it. But even if there wasn't, I mean, this foundation has turned into one of the most powerful organizations in the world. But it's not the only foundation. We have other foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundations or George Soros' foundation. I mean, all these foundations play a very big role in our time. Things have changed. Things have changed, particularly since the 1970s, because now it used to be, until 1970, it used to be that the basis for power was money. If somebody had a lot of money, he had a lot of power. And if people had real big sums of money, they had extreme power. But nowadays, ever since 1970, a new force has come into the foreground, and that is data. I mean, companies like Microsoft and Apple, they were founded in the mid-70s, and they've become extremely powerful. Like nowadays, the biggest five IT companies in the world, they have a market capitalization around $10 trillion, which is just absolutely phenomenal. And they exert a lot of power. They control all the data in this world. And by controlling the data, they control all the big companies, all the big corporations in the world, and all the governments. And that's why organizations like foundations have become so extremely important, because behind them, they have these IT companies and they have the big financial companies. And within the financial realm, we've seen some major changes. Like until the 1970s, 1980s, it was the Wall Street that always was the number one in the financial system. And then after 1970, 1980, big investment banks became even more powerful. And then it was the hedge funds that became more powerful. And then starting in about 2005, 2010, it was the asset managements that became the most powerful forces in the world. And they are now the most powerful forces, with BlackRock being the number one and Vanguard being the number two. BlackRock manages assets worth about $9.5 trillion, and Vanguard manages assets worth about $7.5 trillion. So between the two of them, they're managing about $17 trillion, which is absolutely enormous, which is almost as much as the GDP of the United States.
And who is on the board of trustees of the World Economic Forum?
Oh, you have a lot of prominent names, among them Larry Fink. Larry Fink, the head of BlackRock. So, I mean, everybody can look up the names. They're all on the internet. But there are some outstanding names there, like Christine Lagarde, who was the head of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and is now the head of the ECB, the European Central Bank. And Larry Fink, of course, to me, seems like one of the most important figures of our time, because being the head of BlackRock, and keep in mind that BlackRock is the major shareholder of almost all big companies in the world, especially of the IT companies. So they share their interests. And also there has been a kind of a merger between the financial system and the digital system. BlackRock uploaded its computer system, Aladdin, which contains the most valuable information about the financial system, collected in about 40 years. They uploaded that into the Azure cloud of Microsoft. So these two companies together already form a force that is bigger than anything we've ever seen. And taking together all these seven companies like Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, Microsoft, Facebook on the one hand, on the digital side, and then BlackRock and Vanguard on the financial side, I mean, they're the ones that are controlling the world at the moment.
Yes, and you mentioned Larry Fink and BlackRock. Now, at the very beginning, I guess in 2020, or maybe it was 2019, I can't remember exactly, BlackRock was hired by the Federal Reserve to dispense the CARE funds, so that BlackRock is dispensing all the money to the different companies and whomever and banks from the United States government.
It sounds absolutely crazy, but the Federal Reserve had no chance to pick somebody else because, of course, BlackRock has Aladdin, and they know more about the financial system in the world than anybody else, and they control every market all over the world, so they can set the rules. I mean, the Federal Reserve cannot act against BlackRock. They have to go along with BlackRock, and BlackRock, of course, act in their own interest. But BlackRock is not only the major advisor of the Federal Reserve, they're also the major advisor of the Bank of England and of the ECB, of the European Central Bank. So BlackRock really tells these central banks which way to go, and if they don't follow the rules set up by BlackRock, they will fail. I mean, that's how strong and how powerful BlackRock has gotten.
Yes, and BlackRock can also dictate the policies of the different companies that they fund. Isn't that right?
Sure. They're the major shareholders of all the big companies in the world. Like in Germany, you have 30 big companies, the 30 biggest companies. They all have two big shareholders, biggest shareholders, and they're BlackRock and Vanguard. And that's very interesting because Vanguard at the same time is the biggest shareholder of BlackRock. So what you see here is an enormous concentration of power and of wealth that the world has never seen before. I mean, these companies have more money and they have more power by controlling all the data in the world than any other companies or any other force in the world up to the 21st century.
So then basically, would you say that BlackRock and Vanguard are actually controlling the global financial system?
Absolutely. Together with, there are some other companies that are pretty powerful too, but none as powerful as BlackRock and Vanguard. You will find the names like Fidelity, State Street, or JP Morgan Asset Management, but they manage assets like up to about $2 trillion. But I mean, just take BlackRock with its 9.5 trillion and Vanguard with 7.5 trillion. They are the major players. They're the biggest global players that the world has ever seen, and they control the financial system. But important, the important fact is that they also are sort of intertwined with the big IT companies, with Apple, Microsoft, and Google, because they're major shareholders too.
I'm speaking with author and journalist Ernst Wolf. Today's show, The End Game. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I was shocked in March of 2020 when all independent businesses, save the big box stores and online platforms, were shut down and there was no pushback. I couldn't believe that everyone was going along with the destruction of the economy. How can you account for the acquiescence of business to such a dictatorship?
Well, it's the big businesses that acquiesced because they know that this system that we're living under right now, that this system is broken and will never be repaired. So what they're doing now, right now, what they've been doing since the beginning of 2020 is they're taking down the system very deliberately, and they want to establish a new system. And the new system that will be CBDCs, that will be central bank digital currencies, and they're going for that. But central bank digital currencies, that's slavery, that's absolute slavery, because if their final aim is that everybody should have only one bank account with a central bank, no more bank accounts with the normal banks, and the money creation should be placed only into the hands of the central banks. But that is total control of the population. That means total slavery by a new monetary system. And that system wouldn't be accepted by the majority of the population. So what they're doing now is they're taking down the system and they're creating a big havoc so that in the end they can come to the rescue of the people by implementing a system of universal basic income. I think that's what they're heading for, universal basic income. And what they want to implement that way is CBDC, central bank digital currencies. But the basic fact is that they know that the system as it is right now is broken and it will never be repaired. So their only way out is what Klaus Schwab has described in his book, The Big Reset. He wrote a book called COVID-19, The Big Reset, which was published in July 2020, and which contains sort of the agenda or the script for everything that's been happening. And he said that the system is broken, and he says very, very accurately, he says the system has to be destroyed. He calls it creative destruction. The system has to be destroyed in order to put up a new system. He never talks about central bank digital currencies because he does not want people to know how this new system will be implemented. But the thing is that he very accurately talks about total creative destruction of the present system.
Well, I was about to ask you what you think is the driving force behind lockdowns and the destruction of the real economy. Now, if the present financial system is considered broken, why is that?
Well, because they've created so much money, and that of course causes a major devaluation of the current currencies. See, the system has been broken for a long time. The system broke down, the first time the system broke down was in 1998, when a big hedge fund in New York failed, and they had to prop up the system. And at that time, they could prop up the system by several banks getting together and putting about $4 billion into the system and thus saving the system. Then we had the world financial crisis, in which the problems became even bigger, so that the banks were unable to prop up the system. So then the governments and the states moved in, and they saved the system by using taxpayers' money. And then we had the euro crisis, and then taxpayers' money was not enough anymore. And then they started printing money like crazy, or creating new money. And that has been going on since 2010, 2011. And then they tried to turn around in between 2016 and 2018. Like the Federal Reserve, they started to raise interest rates, because the big central banks, they have two ways of propping up the system. One is creating money, and the other is lowering interest rates. And as of 2016 until 2018, they tried to turn around. And the Federal Reserve, for example, they raised interest rates four times in 2018. Each raise was only by 2.25%. So they raised interest rates by about 1% during 1 year. And the result was disastrous, because the result was that the share markets in the world broke down, that we had the biggest drop in share values in around Christmas time 2018. So that's when Janet Yellen turned up and told the international investors that they would not raise interest rates anymore, but they would lower them again. And then they lowered them again, and then we had the next almost crash of the system in March 2020, and that's when we reached zero interest rates. So from now on, they can only print more money, and that's what they've been doing like crazy during the past year and a half. And that, of course, results in inflation. And we have a major inflation now, like in the U.S. I think the inflation rate is about in between 6 or 8%. Here in Europe, they tell us that it's about 5 to 6%. But everybody knows that it's actually much higher. If you buy food in Germany, the inflation rate is about 50 to 60% right now. So that is an unstoppable process. So we know that we're facing a real wave of inflation now, and that means a total devaluation of all currencies. And of course, that will hit the middle class and the working class much more than the big corporations. So the big corporations and the big banks, they all know that this system is due for a major breakdown. So they are preparing for that. I mean, take a look at what the big investors in America are doing. Bill Gates, for example, is the biggest owner of farmland now. So he knows that money will be worth nothing in the future. But also, he started this big company, Microsoft, and they will survive. I mean, they have done a lot with their assets. They have bought up all sorts of fixed assets, and they're not relying on money anymore. And they know that once the system is started again, they will be controlling the system by controlling the data. So what we're seeing is a process that is benefiting the big companies. They can live with all these shutdowns or lockdowns, whereas the middle class cannot live with that. The middle class is being targeted by the biggest big companies right now, and the middle class will be the big loser of this struggle and this fight right now. You can see that the middle class are losing out. They are being bought up by lots of scouts either from big banks or from big corporations. And the major group of scouts here in Germany that is now buying up companies all over the place comes from China. So what we're seeing is the destruction, the total destruction of the middle class. And if they implement this CBDC system, that these central bank digital currencies, it will be the big companies and the big corporations that are the big winners.
Now, when you say that it's impossible for the banks to increase interest rates, is that because it hurts the stock market and it also makes the debt harder to handle?
Right. You will not be able to service your debt. And the amount of debt in the world today is the biggest amount of debt we've ever had. We have about $300 trillion in debt. That is household debt, that is corporate debt, and that is government debt. And that debt has to be serviced day by day. And in order to be able to serve it, you have to have very, very low interest rates. And interest rates now are at zero or near zero. And if you raise them, it becomes harder to service this debt. And also, of course, it becomes harder to service finance your engagement in the financial markets. And then you have BlackRock and Vanguard. For example, if the Federal Reserve only tried to raise interest rates by another 0.25% or 0.5%, it would be Vanguard and BlackRock that could bring down any market in the world. That could bring down any share market in the world. And so the central banks, they have been hijacked by these big asset management companies.
And what about the 2010 Rockefeller plan in four parts, one part called lockdown? It seems that what is happening today has been planned for a long time. How does the lockdown somehow service or serve the financial powers?
Well, the lockdown is a way to bring down the middle class, because it's the middle class that doesn't get any loans from their banks anymore. And they're the ones that really suffer from this. I mean, the big companies, see, they got all sorts of money from the governments in order to help them out. Like here in Germany, the big air corporations, they got a lot of money. The car companies, they got a lot of money. But the middle class, they only got very, very small amounts of money. And they are the ones that are hit hardest by the lockdowns. The big ones, they will be able to survive. I mean, they've hoarded so much cash in the past, and they've bought up so many assets in the past that they can survive like 3, 4, 5 years of lockdowns. Take a look at, for example, Uber. Uber, who have lived without any profits for, I think it was about 6 or 7 years. But they have big money behind them. They have the Saudi trust behind them. And these people, they can live with big losses for several years. But their aim is to dominate the world market in the end. And that's what they're aiming for. So they can live with losses for a long time. And right now we see that the big companies, either in America or in Europe or even in China, they can live with big losses for a long time. But it's the middle class that's being targeted, and the middle class is being destroyed.
And what is meant by the fourth industrial revolution? I've heard you say that there's going to be a tremendous amount of job loss.
Yes, it's the introduction of artificial intelligence. I mean, artificial intelligence is taking over at a speed never seen before. See, just take a look at autonomous vehicles. What does it mean? I mean, they want to introduce autonomous vehicles by 2030. That will mean, that will have the consequence that all drivers of lorries or vans or drivers of locomotives or even airplane captains, they will be without jobs. I mean, just if I just look at Germany, that will mean that about 800,000 people lose their jobs. Or if you take a look at what they're trying to introduce through the lockdowns is home office and homeschooling. Take a look at homeschooling. That's a major aim, is to replace all sorts of teachers by setting people or pupils in front of big screens. And all you need then is like one teacher for thousands and thousands of pupils. You can save, like in Germany, you have 800,000 teachers right now. You would be able to do with 800 teachers. So 799,000, 800 would lose their jobs. It's absolutely incredible. And if you take a look at other parts of the economy, AI is progressing at a speed never seen before. And people will be losing their jobs in the tens or hundreds of millions all over the world. And of course, that will mean that these people will be lost as consumers. And that will mean that these people will be have reinstalled into the system as consumers. And that will be done by introducing CBDCs, by central bank government, via universal basic income. Because if somebody does not have a job, but you want him to stimulate the economy, you have to give him some money. So these people will be given universal basic income in order, not in order to help them, it's not a humanitarian act, but in order to keep them functioning as consumers within the system.
I'm speaking with author and journalist Ernst Wolf. Today's show, The End Game. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, you've mentioned central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs. Now, these are blockchain, aren't they? How does blockchain work?
Well, blockchain is a system that works. Just to be able to explain it for people who don't know what it's about. If you send an email, you write an email and you send a duplicate of this email. Or if you send somebody a picture via internet, you have this picture on your computer and you send them a duplicate. But if you work on a blockchain, you do not send the duplicate of the picture, you send the original picture to the other person. So that picture is no longer with you, but is with the other person. And that has been used for the financial system. Like Bitcoin, for example, is based on blockchain. If you have a one Bitcoin, for example, and you want to send it to somebody else, you can do that via your computer. You can send the other person one Bitcoin. That Bitcoin is no longer on your computer and no longer yours. That Bitcoin then is on the computer of the other person. So that's the way blockchain works. But there's a big difference between Bitcoin and all the cryptocurrencies that are around right now, because they kind of evade the banking system. They are kind of they are blockchain based and in a sort of democratic way, because they do not work through financial intermediaries. But central bank digital currencies are totally the opposite of this. They may be blockchain based, but they will be totally controlled by those that hand out the money, by the central banks. The central banks will be able to see every financial transaction of every person that is within the CBD system. So that will mean total control, and that will lead to total slavery by CBDCs.
Do you think that the replacement of the current global financial system with central bank digital currencies will be successful?
I do not think that it will be successful. I think that it's an attempt to prop up a system that has failed, and they will face major problems even if they are able to implement it. I think they will face major social resistance. Just like right now, they're facing major social resistance with this health regime that they've put up. I mean, here in Europe, you can see that people are protesting in large numbers, and I think that's also valid for the US. I think people are not buying the stories that they are being told anymore. And the same will happen to the central banks, digital currencies. There will be a major social resistance, and also the system in the end will not work. Because you cannot implement people as consumers by handing out money to them without constantly producing a major steps forward in inflation. So this system will end in a spiral of inflation that will be uncontrollable. So I think that will just be a system that will work for a short period of time, but in the long run will also fail.
Well, how exactly do central bank digital currencies, how can they be inflated the way dollars are? I don't quite understand.
Because people will keep losing their jobs because of the fourth industrial revolution, and you will have more and more people out of jobs, and you will have to finance these people in order to keep them as consumers. That's the major problem, because CBDCs are not a humanitarian thing. They are not meant to keep people from starving, and they're only meant to keep people in the system as consumers. But to keep them into the system as consumers means you have to give more money to more people, because the army of jobless people will keep mounting. You will have millions of millions that will need universal basic income. And the more people that need universal basic income, the more people you have, the more CBDCs you will have to usher. And that way, this system will be spiraling itself into oblivion at some time.
Well, right. And it's also a system of total control, right?
That is right, because the central bank will know about every single financial transaction, and it will be able to cut people off from all financial flows. They will be able to usher a social credit system. Like if you don't pay your rent, you won't get any universal basic income. Or if you take part in certain demonstrations that are not allowed to take part in, they will be able to give you less money, or even to totally cut you off from all money flows. I mean, that's what has already been implemented in China. If you want to look at the future of what awaits us here in Europe or you in the US, you only have to look at China. They are about three or four steps ahead. They already have handed out 140 million wallets with CBDC. There, they have tested CBDCs, and they're probably the first nation on Earth that will be able to usher CBDCs. And they will also have a major advantage over the United States, because they will be able to pass out the CBDCs not only in China, but along the One Belt, One Road. And thus be able to put out this currency all over the Middle East and even in some countries of Africa. So that will be giving them a big advantage over the U.S. And I think the U.S. has a big problem with that. And maybe even the things that happened around Afghanistan had something to do with that, because the U.S. all of a sudden left Afghanistan. And I think they might have been blackmailed by the Chinese. The Chinese might have told them, we are going to usher CBDCs if you don't get out of Afghanistan. That could be the background, and that might explain why the Americans got out of Afghanistan so quickly.
Yes, that's an interesting point. The U.S. exit from Afghanistan seemed like it was overly rushed, and they shut down the Bagram Air Force Base, which I've been told would have been the logical way for them to exit Afghanistan, but they just walked away from it.
Right. There must have been somebody behind all this. And I think that one should look into this race between the United States and between China, because they're working on this central bank digital currency. They're not telling people about it, but the Americans are testing it on the Bahamas. They have ushered the sand dollar there. It's 380,000 people who already have a central bank digital currencies. And they're also testing it on some very small islands in the Caribbean. And the Chinese have tested it in some of their major cities like Shenzhen. So there's a race going on behind the scenes between these two countries. And very visibly, China is leading in this race.
People talk about communism and the Chinese Communist Party, but China has a capitalist economy, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. China has switched over from a communist system, from a planned economy, to the most rampant capitalist system that we've ever seen. I mean, China is some sort of turbo capitalism, and they're benefiting from the times when they had this planned economy, because that was when the Communist Party ruled China, and the Communist Party is a centralized system of power, and this centralized system of power is very, very effective. And take this centralized system of power and combine it with capitalism, and you have the most horrible turbo capitalism the world has ever seen. I mean, China is 100% capitalist, and it's absolutely ridiculous that the Communist Party is still called the Communist Party.
Who controls the banking system in China?
Oh, that is mostly a shadow banking system. It's not controlled by partly controlled by the Communist Party, but it's also controlled by the big IT companies in China. Because in China, you also have a digital financial complex. You have these big companies, and the funny thing is that even one of their biggest personalities in the IT business, the Chinese Bill Gates, who is called Jack Ma, he was also trained by the World Economic Forum. He was in one of their classes. But in China, you have this digital financial sector on the one side, and you have the Communist Party on the other side. And the two of them, they are engaging in a big struggle for power right now. And I think that the Chinese Communist Party has kind of made an alliance with the American digital financial complex. Because in May, you had a very interesting meeting in Beijing. That was the International Financial Forum, which is sort of the Chinese version of the World Economic Forum. It's a big foundation headed by Chinese, by the Chinese Communist Party. But within this corporation, within the board of directors, you will find all sorts of names like Christine Lagarde, like Horst Köhler, who used to be the head of the IMF. You will find the ex-head of the European Central Bank. You will find all sorts of people from Western financial system. And at this conference, one of the leading caterers of the Communist Party of China came out and said that the Chinese central bank digital currency might be issued on the network of either Ethereum or Diem. And Diem is the follow-up to Libra, and Libra is nothing but Mark Zuckerberg's cryptocurrency for Facebook. So that tells me that the Chinese Communist Party behind the scenes is working together with the digital financial complex of the West.
Well, that was going to be my next question, as to how infiltrated has China become with Western financial power? It's all integrated, right? It's not as if the Chinese financial sector is separate from the West.
No, it's integrated. And for example, Larry Fink is the first big representative from the West who's being allowed to do business in China. BlackRock is very active in China at the moment. And BlackRock, we know how strong and how powerful BlackRock is. And the Chinese economic system is very, very closely connected to the Western world. And they're having some major trouble right now. But they are also planning this big takedown of the system. Like, they have these problems with Evergrande. But these problems with Evergrande, they were caused by the Chinese Communist Party. Because the Chinese Communist Party set up some new rules about 3 months ago, and they knew very exactly that these rules would hurt Evergrande, so that Evergrande would be in big trouble. So they produced these problems. So what I think is that they're also trying to take down their system in order to, in the last analysis, implement CBDCs. I think what we're seeing right now is that the whole world is in danger of facing the most, the biggest financial takedown in history.
I'm speaking with author and journalist Ernst Wolf. Today's show, The End Game. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, that's very interesting that you see the Chinese trying to take down their own economy the way it's being implemented in the West, that they're doing the same thing.
Exactly. But they, even if they wanted to do differently, they couldn't. Because there are certain laws that the economy works by, and then they apply for China as well as for the West. You can raise interest, you can lower interests up to a certain point. But once you reach 0% interest rates, the system can no longer work with negative interest rates. Banks, the banking system cannot work in the long run and cannot work with negative interest rates. And we are hitting negative interest rates. We've hit negative interest rates last year. And so all they can do now is produce more money. And more money devalues money and creates inflation. And that's what we're seeing. And that destroys all the currencies all over the world. And that's what we're seeing right now, this process.
How does the Russian Federation fit into all of this? Are they doing the lockdowns and this whole mask wearing and everything like the rest of the world?
They're doing it like the rest of the world. They're creating their own vaccines. They're implementing lockdowns. People have to be wearing masks over there. But they're facing major opposition in the population because the Russian population, I mean, they know what a dictatorship looks like. They've lived under a horrible Stalinist dictatorship for a long time. And they're opposing this in a way that we've not seen in the West. But Russia has a major advantage too at the moment, because Russia is largely depends on its real economy, is not as dependent on its financial system as, for example, China and the US and Europe. Russia is a major exporter of oil and of gas, and therefore is pretty important for the other countries at the moment. They're in a better position. Also, they have large amounts of gold. They've bought large amounts of gold. So they're not as affected by this crisis right now. So they might in the end be the big winner. But I don't know what will happen. But we should not believe that the Russian economy is not dependent on the Western economy. They're intertwined with the Western banks as China is. But they have these major resources of raw materials, and that might be a major factor for them to benefit from this crisis.
I see. So you're saying that the Russian Federation economy is not as financialized as, say, China or the West?
No, because historically it's behind. It's much behind everybody else. I mean, they've financialized everything they could financialize, but it's largely an agricultural economy. They're largely, because of all these sanctions that have been implemented, they're largely dependent on their own food supplies right now. And of course, they're the world's major exporter of oil and gas. And so that puts them in an advantageous position.
Exactly. And I'm glad you brought up the fact that the U.S. sanctions against Russia has actually worked in Russia's behalf.
That is true, right.
What do you make of the cyber polygon drills carried out by the World Economic Forum that entail the shutting down of the internet? What's that all about?
That might be another scheme to hurry up the breakdown of the system. See, one way to break down the system is to make the financial system collapse. But if you want to really scare people, then you could collapse the internet for a few days because nothing would work anymore then. So that way it could create major havoc all around the world. And I think that's what they're heading for. What they're heading for is civil wars all over the world so that they can come up at the end and in the end come up and say, we will save you from starvation. We will give you universal basic income. I think that's the final aim of what we're seeing right now. And that's the final aim of the agenda that has been pushed forward for about 2 years now. I think it has nothing to do with health. It's all about the economy, it's all about the financial system, and it's all about power. It's about the people that are in power now, and they're trying to stay in power.
Yes, and creating chaos and civil war works to their advantage, right?
Exactly.
Well, we see this here in the United States with the pitting of different races against each other and the cancel culture. It's like they're trying to make everybody go against everybody else.
Same thing over here in Europe, yes.
Oh, is that right?
This gender agenda or this racial agenda, it's the same thing over here. And the problem behind all of this is that you have these social media these days that control people's opinions, and the social media are controlled by the big IT companies, and the big IT companies are controlled by BlackRock and Vanguard. So it's always the same players. It's always the same players in the background. It's the same puppeteers that are steering the agenda that we're going through right now.
Yes, and could you talk a little bit more about the social media, the power of the social media? I mean, I've heard you mention, and of course I've thought a lot about it myself, is that Twitter kicked President Trump off of Twitter.
Now that shows you who's really in power in these days, because everybody thought that Donald Trump, as the President of the United States, was the most powerful man in the world, but he was not. He never was, and no American president ever will be the most powerful man in the world, because this man can be shut off by Twitter, and Twitter is part of this social media system, and the social media, they are controlled by about five big companies, and behind these five big companies, you have the major asset management companies. So the world is actually controlled by people like Larry Fink, Bill Gates, or Elon Musk. And not by the politicians. The politicians are nothing but puppets. They're being steered by the puppeteers.
Due to COVID-19, WMFO DJs are pre-recording their shows for broadcast on air. We can still accept phone calls, but the phone line is in voicemail mode. Call 855-915-9636 and be sure to leave the DJ's name in the voicemail so we can forward it to the correct person. The following program was recorded earlier. Enjoy.